talk about the clinical aspects of asbestos, and some of that you've already heard. So I'm here to talk about the clinical aspects of asbestos disease. I come to you, as you heard earlier, from Drexel University. And again, for those of you that may not know, I'm sure many of you here do, but asbestos is a group of naturally occurring fibers that cause a range of human diseases. It's not something made by man. It's extracted out of the ground, processed. And the important point is that all fiber types are responsible for the production of disease. It's not just the 5 amphiboles. It is also the serpentine form that we call the white asbestos or chrysotile. If you don't go away with anything else, just remember that chrysotile asbestos, no matter what the Canadians want to tell you, is not the safe asbestos. You can't sprinkle it on your breakfast cereal and eat it with impunity. You heard from Dr. Lemon's slides about the case of the gentleman who died around 1900, and this is actually a piece of tissue taken at his autopsy by Dr. Montague Murray, and you'll see in the right upper corner there is a somewhat clear asbestos body. This was actually found. He didn't know what to call it at the time. He called it a curious body. But this is from the autopsy of that 33-year-old gentleman, so clearly asbestos was found in the tissue. Yeah. Oh, there it is. There it is. There it is. Okay. There it is. That is the asbestos body. And when Dr. Montague Murray wrote this case up, and this was 1906, one hears generally speaking that considerable trouble is now taken to prevent the inhalation of dust, and so the disease is not so likely to occur as heretofore. Wow. 1906. Wow. He didn't exactly get it right, did he? So what is the spectrum of asbestos-related disease? Well, I'm a simple kind of guy. I try to think about things in simple ways, and I figure there's the non-malignant diseases and the cancers. The non-malignant diseases are asbestos warts. It can get under your skin. Minor problem. You don't see it very often, but it needs to be mentioned. Benign asbestotic pleural effusions. The first disease to show up within 10 years of exposure to asbestos in most cases is a benign asbestotic effusion. It's benign because there's no cancer. Scares the heck out of the clinician because it's a bloody effusion. You're looking for the cancer. You don't find it. And then you have parenchymal and pleural asbestosis. For those of you that don't understand the term pleural asbestosis and think of things as pleural plaques or pleural thickening, pleural disease, that was a reinvention of science done back in the 1960s when lawsuits came into being. The original description of pneumoconioses or dust diseases of the lungs goes back to 1867. To a German pathologist by the name of Zenker, who said that the dust diseases of the lung involve the lung and the pleura. And if you read the textbooks of the 1930s, the book on silicosis and asbestosis that was common in that era, also talks about the pleural aspects of asbestosis. And it was with the reinvention of a particular pathologist who was helping out the asbestos industry, I suspect, in having pleural disease not classified as asbestosis, so it could be called at the time a beauty mark or a indicator of exposure, got us away from thinking about it as pleural asbestosis. But if you read Solikoff's text from 1976, that's a term that he uses. The thing about asbestos, there are a lot of occupational carcinogens, obviously, but this is one that causes a wide range of cancers. Lung cancer, mesothelioma of the pleura, the peritoneum, the pericardial, and other sites. GI tract cancers are found in excess, esophagus, stomach, colon, and rectal cancers. Laryngeal cancer, oropharyngeal cancers, and in excess of kidney cancer. So it's a wide spectrum of disease, and not all of those are considered sometimes in the data that we look at. We need to remember that these diseases are often misdiagnosed and or underreported. Dr. Solikoff, working with Dr. Suzuki, a pathologist that he had at the Environmental Sciences Laboratory, showed that many cases of mesothelioma were misreported as lung cancers or carcinomatosis, and were not recognized for what they are. What is interesting, things have changed. There are now much better histologic materials available that even the community pathologist in a small hospital today can get a pretty accurate diagnosis of most mesotheliomas. But even sometimes that is difficult, and that's why we still have things like the U.S.-Canadian mesothelioma panel that will look at difficult cases, or sometimes cases are sent to the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, one of the largest collections of mesotheliomas being housed there because of young naval officers who started in the engine rooms of ships and got their mesotheliomas when they were captains and admirals. The symptoms are often nonspecific, shortness of breath, pain in the chest, cough, abdominal pain. It's a condition that is not always clearly appreciated. There are lots of things that can do this. And so it's often very late in the diagnosis or very late in the case till a proper diagnosis is made. As I mentioned already, Merriweather and Price talked about their work in 1930. But in that paper where they talked about who got disease, they also talked about another very important principle, which isn't always thought of, which is you need to educate workers. We don't do that enough. This is 1930. You need to educate workers about hazardous materials so they can protect themselves. They talked about better ventilation, and they talked about if you can't put enough ventilation in, you need to put workers in respirators. This was 1930. There's the concept of duration of exposure versus duration from onset of exposure. How long do you have to be exposed to asbestos to get disease is one issue, and then when does the disease show up? So let's clarify that. First, let's look at the data on which types of asbestos cause disease, and this is work of Dr. Wagner, who went to his grave claiming that chrysotile didn't cause mesothelioma. But as you see here, you got as many lung cancers with Canadian chrysotile as you did with chrysotilite, and you got just as many mesotheliomas in his own work. How much does it take? That same study with animals showed that literally one day of exposure would give rise to both lung cancers and mesotheliomas. And while it's not common in the human condition, there are published data. Morris Greenberg, for example, from Great Britain, published in The Lancet in 1985 of a man who cut some asbestos boards in his backyard one day to build a shed, built the shed, thought nothing more of it, and 30 years later developed his mesothelioma. So there are these case reports, and certainly very short periods of exposure. I mentioned the Tyler plant. The earlier iteration of that had been a plant in Paterson, New Jersey, and Dr. Solikoff showed that with 1 month or less, 1 month or less of exposure, there was a doubling of the risk of developing lung cancer working in that factory. So you don't need much. The duration of exposure was short. On the other hand, when does the disease show up? As you see from these curves, disease begins to appear at about 10 years. The peak here for lung cancer is out at about 30 years. Mesotheliomas and asbestosis deaths are out a bit further. It seems like a long time, but remember, these were workers who, when they were 16 or 18, went to work in the Insulators Union. 40 years later, you're still quite young developing these diseases. Where are the significant risk occupations? Asbestos mining and milling, manufacturing, construction, shipbuilding and ship repair, power facilities, railroads, and there are other exposures, and we'll hear some about that. Household contacts, consumer products, demolition and waste disposal, sprayed surfaces and public buildings. Let's try to bring that to life a little bit. Anybody recognize that building? That's the World Trade Center being built. And here's an asbestos insulator spraying asbestos on a steel beam at that facility. 40 floors of one tower were sprayed with asbestos in 1972. The ban came in on the spraying of asbestos. The rest of that tower and the other tower were sprayed with other materials. So here he is spraying asbestos on a steel beam, and as you see, some of it even stayed on the beam. What happened to the rest of it? This is what the laborer would come by and sweep up. This is what the electrician was exposed to. This is what the brick mason was exposed to. So it isn't just the 1% of construction workers who directly handle asbestos, but virtually all construction workers at this period of time were significantly exposed to asbestos. Then we have this. No matter what the automobile industry and the brake manufacturers want to tell you, there is plenty of disease that comes from brake dust. Here's something that about 1 million workers in this country do, is work on brakes. If you ever come to visit me in my office, you'll see this sitting up on my shelf. It was a gift to me of a gentleman who no longer had need of his leak-proof asbestos liquid roof coating. And I could show you many, many more products, but the point is that there were between 3,000 and 4,000 products made with asbestos in its day. And yet here we are without a ban in this country, with 50 countries in the world with a ban. Their cars stop, they don't have more fires, you know, things work just fine. Here was something that was really sort of one of the more bizarre things, a coat made of processed wool that had 20% asbestos in it. At least we knew enough to put our lab tech in a proper respirator as we brushed it to see how much asbestos was liberated. School children were subjected to making the asbestos head with leftover papier-mâché materials from asbestos processing that was recycled into materials for use by school children. And here I am, a physician, and I used to and still prescribe medications for patients. And until it was banned by the FDA, asbestos was used as a filtering agent, and we would be injecting asbestos fibers into our patients every time we gave them Valium, penicillin, streptomycin, or whatever, because it ended up in the vials along with the drug that we were trying to put into people. To finish up, none of us will really forget that day. We saw the World Trade Center going up. Here's a picture of it coming down. This is what Lower Manhattan looked like, with 4% asbestos and some of the dust. It varied, but it was up as high as 4%. The biggest problem, of course, has turned out to be the concrete material with a very high pH. You notice the steel beam there with, I don't know if this is an asbestos-coated beam or not, but this is the kind of exposures that workers had. Anybody know what happened to all that steel? I mean, a few steel beams ended up in the new ship that just got launched this year, the USS New York, but a lot of it was recycled over to India and to China, shipped over with the asbestos on it that the workers over there could take off before we sent it over to them. So the legacies of the past, if we stopped using it today, we'd still have projected disease and death for the next 30, 40, 50 years. We still continue to use it. Engineering controls are not well developed. In this country, we talk about regulatory feasibility. The Canadians talk about the safe use of asbestos. We still have legal uncharted complexities. Over 80 companies have gone bankrupt. And we need to remember that there are 25 million tons of asbestos in over 700,000 buildings in this country put in place. So even if we stop putting any more in, we have to worry about how we deal with it and taking it out. So we need to educate physicians, workers, and others, and to use asbestos substitutes. And with that, I'll finish my comments.